This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, on KPWLP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peace Works Independent Community Radio. Okay, this week, they're at it again, Ariel Spring. The people of Lincoln County over there at Beaver Creek in Seal Rock have been notified, luckily, at least, that they're being sprayed anywhere from September 2nd through November. So we have a report from, thankfully, from Whole Community News with Willow from the StopTheSpray.com campaign, and they have a GoFundMe site at Protect Beaver Creek at GoFundMe. Just search Protect Beaver Creek on the GoFundMe site or on Google, and it will come up. Yeah, clear cutting is monocropping. You wouldn't need pesticides if we did not use clear cutting on a large scale, because plants and animals and insects have evolved to live together pretty much in harmony. Nature has a way of healing itself pretty quickly, until man came along. So, yeah, up next, Ariel Spring. Stop Ariel Spring. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. Support independent media.
Lincoln County voters once banned Ariel Spring, but the state took them to court. The state of Oregon has now approved chemical spraying above Beaver Creek, spraying that could start as early as September 2nd. Residents of the Seal Rock Water District are asking everyone in Oregon to join them as water protectors. Willow Kastner.
I've been up there since I grew up on this land. I've been here, my family's been here for five generations. We have a seabird that flies over our wetlands. We hear them at night. We have the marble murrelet, which is endangered. Well, they live up here, and they live up in the big trees in the older growth forests, up in the headlands and the upstate. It takes a whole long time to find them. They're here. There's at least a couple, because once I learned what it was, I've always wondered what that sound was, which means pass from. We all grew up playing in the forest here, riding horses around, having our cattle healthily on the grass. My cousin has a horse and cattle ranch right in the wetland, right where the spray will accumulate. She's got a huge section of wetland. I've got a smaller section. I'm letting my farm, my family farm, turn back into a wetland. And I allow campers to come out here and enjoy it. I also have events once in a while. And so what do I do with people staying here? You know, I've got a memorial coming up in 2 weeks. I've got a group camp out this weekend with a whole bunch of families and children. What do I do if they start spraying, you know? It's one of the most important coastal coho salmon runs on Oregon, and it's not being protected. The president just awarded millions of dollars to, so they're spending all this money to save the salmon and to save these species and to restore habitat, and at the same time, the state is allowing this destruction to happen on a local level. That's why it's such a big Oregon statewide issue and not just a Lincoln County issue, because it's 40% of Oregon timberlands are owned by private timber industry and companies. The Oregon Forestry Act is made in a way that basically all they have to do is notify the forest department, the Oregon Forest, and then they have the right to go ahead and spray if their written plan is, you know, upholding to the law, which I've read the written plans, and our particular spray, the Beaver Creek aerial spray, is such a basic cookie-cutter written plan. It doesn't account for so many things we feel it needs to be accounted for in order to be an acceptable written plan, but we don't have the go-ahead because their office already says it falls within the rules, it's acceptable, and clearly it's not acceptable. There's about houses within 100 to 300 feet of the spray, so right next to the target line. And there are buffers they have to uphold, which is 300 feet away from a house. and a certain amount away from creeks, and most of us within a mile of the spray zone. A couple of people in the community had were already plugged into their Department of Forestry with an online notification system, which is called FERNS, all capitals, FERNS, sent in by the deadline of 100 comments to the Toledo Department of Forestry, West Oregon Division. And they, in the past, had received maybe a few altogether from any of these situations. So going from zero to a few written comments, but we went up to 100, almost 100. And also that time period, over 2,000 signatures on a petition that went around in about a week and a half as well. Our first meeting we had, the Oak Water District, about 40 people or more, about 20 in person and about 20 on Zoom. And basically what he says, there is nobody here, nobody that can overrule this. The Oregon Forestry Act is law, basically. The landowner himself has to decide to stop it. Based on everything that, you know, going on, the community uproar and all of the media coverage and all of the officials, we're hoping and we are praying and putting our faith in the fact that they will not want to spray us after all of the uproar and all the concern. The state representative, David Gomberg, has been out. He was at the meeting. He's made posts about it. He's made, you know, in his weekly information that he sends out to everybody. It's been in it a couple different weeks, at least. He sent notifications to the consultant company in Washington that runs the A&E Forests of Oregon, which is, it's Soren Nymark is the owner, and he is from Denmark. So Gomberg has reached out, I assume more than once, to ask for a meeting between him, state officials, local officials, and the Silver Rock Water District. They're looking into a second water source. So that water source is all, which they had before they got the Silver Rock water source. And it's going to cost quite a bit of money if I can't serve over a certain, you know, dangerous amount of chemicals. The problem is that the Silette water source is also has an aerial spray application put in for their area as well. So it's extra scary because everybody's getting it kind of at once right now. And I border the creek, Beaver Creek. And so all of our water sources come from downstream of these sprays that are going to happen. And so we all have to take samples of our water, our soil, and possibly our urine, now as base samples, get them tested at a lab, sampling the whole entire time throughout the spray and after for months, especially once the rains start. Once the rains come, then all these chemicals that have been sitting on the soil roll down into the groundwater that way, and they also roll down through runoff and through come directly down to all the water sources. These tests cost, the last test somebody looked into a lab, last one that we found was upwards of $200 per test, per sample. And everybody basically that we've talked to in the county is on board with stopping this spray and eventually changing the laws at a state level, changing legislature, because it is completely unfair. This is the United States of America, supposedly, and we are just in this whole global problem. It's way bigger than Oregon. Global problem of big companies being able to get through laws because they're either made too easy in favor of them or because they are archaic rules that do not apply to the situation nowadays. And this is happening all over the world. I see the GoFundMe from Costa Rica. It's a mother and baby on the cover of it. Don't let them poison our water, basically. So this is worldwide. And as we know, there's a million crazy things happening worldwide. And all we can really do is start with ourselves. And we're not allowed legally to start with ourselves. That's the problem. Because in 2017, our county did pass a ban to ban aerial spraying. In 2017, Lincoln County passed that ban by popular vote. Because of preemptive law, which basically states the county does not have the right to make a law or change a law underneath of the state. The state has power to take that back. So they went into circuit court or county court or state, went into court. It lasted about a couple years, went into court, and of course got overturned because deep in there is the preemptive law. And so we were told in that very first meeting at the Duoc Water District that the only way to change legislation is from the top down. So that's what we have to do. And we need everybody to join in on that as soon as possible, ideally in the next couple days. We need your help right now. Please help us protect all of Lincoln County, all of Oregon. This has got to stop. There are things in this world we cannot control at this point. However, this one we can. That's why we need to do it. That's why we need to band together, get this legislature changed, and in the meantime, get this particular aerial spray not to happen. Not to happen. We do not need more of our precious ecosystems poisoned. It's a lush, beautiful, beautiful, dense, gorgeous, amazing forest up here. And now, what's left of them, because of all the private, huge private timber companies, and I'm not talking local logging companies. I'm not only fifth generation, but specifically fifth generation logging family. My family has logged since they came to this state and to the side of the world. They're also commercial fishermen, loggers, carpenters. Everybody uses wood. We understand that. It's a beautiful thing that we have the ability to use because we're from here, just like the fish that are from here. We take care of them. We get to continue to eat them. This is a main staple of meat and sustenance for the people of this land since the beginning of time. And they are close to not making it on this creek. I've been up there lately and seen the clear-cut areas and seen the buffer zones that they leave on these precious creeks. And the unhealthiness, the dryness underneath, the dryness of the ground, the fact that the little pebbles, the dirt clods in the ground roll right down into the creek because there's no buffers on some sides. It is completely terrible habitat, and it's not going to keep making it. And people can use the excuse, well, it's been fine up till now. It's not going to be fine again, right? All of the state officials, everybody in the state government, over and over and over, these letters to the editor. In local papers, they refer to that note about Beaver Creek aerial spray, which is really important as far as, being clear on what they want to stop now. And writing personal letters in if they've had experiences with and family experiences with, chemical trespass in the past, because maybe some of the state officials don't understand how bad it's been for 30 years. Maybe somehow they missed all that, because not everybody knows. A lot of people thought that the Lincoln County ban was still on and we would never get aerial sprayed again. But they didn't, that's not true. People don't know about this stuff. And our small families, our drinking water sources, our farms, we're also a farming state, our ranches. There's the Steel Rock, the Beaver Creek Protected Natural Area here. We've got State Park right here in Beaver Creek, less than a mile from getting sprayed. There's a Brian Boone State Park. There's the Beaver Creek State Park. People kayak up this creek. There are, the companies that rent kayaks out. This is a big, way bigger than just the 60 families directly, affected by the spray and the 5,500 other local residents drinking the contaminated water. We have a website that one of our community members has put together. We have a GoFundMe that's been put together. Reach out and they can contact us through the website.
That website is named StopTheSpray.com. There, GoFundMe is named Protect Beaver Creek Watershed. This is John Quetzalcoatl Murray for KEPW 97.3, Whole Community News.
Good evening, and again, welcome. Okay, our first speakers. Overview of the Oregon Forest Practices Act. That is Link Smith.
I was asked here, I appreciate the invitation, by the way, but I was asked to come here tonight to give you kind of a brief overview of the Department of Forestry's Forest Practices Act, the Oregon Forest Practices Act, and specifically speak a little bit more to the chemical side or the chemical application of herbicides and how we apply those rules in our agency. So the next thing I'm going to say, just to put a quick plug in, Oregon happened to have the very first Forest Practices Act in the nation. That was enacted in 1971. And that's been a continuing changes have evolved, you know, as new science becomes available to us. There's been a series of changes to that act, so it's kind of ever-changing set of rules, basically, as we find new information. So it's pretty neat that it's as old and established as it is. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is our notification process. Any operation that has to do with the growing and harvesting of trees in Oregon has to go through a notification. So that means if they are going to go build road into a unit, or if they're cutting the trees down, or if they're burning the slash, or if they're spraying herbicides on the unit to control vegetation, there's a notification process, and they have to turn in that intent, or an intent to perform that operation. And really what that is, you see there, it's a communication tool for us. And so really what we're charged with by the legislature, we have two charges, and that is to ensure that trees are growing again after they have been removed. So if you've harvested trees, we make sure that people replant and establish a new forest. And the other is to protect our natural resources. And so this is a notification here as a communication tool with us. So if you're going to go harvest timber, you come to us and tell us what your intent to do is on your property. And our job is to tell you what resources are out there, whether it be fish or spotted owls or eagles or murrelet or you name it. Our job is to help communicate with you what those resources are and what you have to do to ensure protection of those resources. And this is the tool that you use. Part of that tool can include a written plan. Written plans are more specific information that we request from you. So for instance, if you have what we call a fish stream on your property, we're going to ask, if you're going to cut trees so close to it, we're going to make you turn in additional information to communicate how you're going to protect that resource. That'll include the buffer distance or specifically what kind of machinery you're going to use to do that. Something else that I thought a lot of folks might be interested in, being from Western Lane, we have in Lane County a great deal of interest in the harvesting operations, or just what I call timber management operations there. And so we have a subscription service. What that is, it's $25 minimum fee, and you can sign up for as many as 5 sections on that. A section is a square mile of land. And with that, when somebody turns in a notification, we will turn that information around and send it to you so you know what's going on in that section of land that you signed up for. We have, just to boast a little bit, I don't know if it's boasting, but we have more subscribers in my district in Western Lane, I believe, than any other district put together, all the other districts put together. So there's just a lot of interest there. there is, you'll see it's fee-based there. There's been a lot of consternation over the fact that why would we charge for that information, and what I'd want to tell you is, again, think about historically 10 years ago even, when somebody turns in a notification, it's all on paper. Then we input it into a computer program, but for us to get that information to you, we've got to turn around and put it in an envelope and mail it to you. And that takes a lot of administration time and costs, and so that's why that fee was established. Currently, when I say that there's a lot of changes going on in the Forest Practices Act, we're going through a new program that's called FERNS, the Forest, help me out here, Forest Electronic Reporting and Notification System. And that's being built right as we speak right now, and it's actually in a trial phase, basically stepping up to the plate and becoming more electronic like the rest of the world here. And so I wouldn't be surprised in very soon coming years that subscription or that kind of information, if you want to know what's going on near your home, that information will be available online to you, and my guess is it'll be at a reduced price from that as well. Regarding the chemical rules, chemicals referred to as pesticides, typically most of the pesticides that we use in forestry are actually herbicides. Personally, in the 12 or 14 years that I've done worked around the stewardship forestry program, there were some rodenticides that were used for the mountain beaver, but 99.9% of any of the pesticides we talk about are actually herbicides. Basically, it's a management tool. The good thing, and what I always tell the people about this country here is, we live in some of the best tree growing ground in the world. We truly do. That same ground makes it some of the best brush growing ground in the world as well. And I think if any of you are homeowners or own just a small piece of land in this country, you'd understand that. And when I say that we have a charge to ensure that trees are grown or replaced after they've been removed in a harvesting operation, the herbicides that we typically work with or oversee the use of are there to control the brush, and that brush they need to control simply to try to get the trees, you know, get their get above the brush and get a good foothold before the brush takes them over. One of the misunderstandings, most misunderstood things about the chemical use in forestry is people think that they're out there spraying it every year like you do on your lawn to get rid of weeds. Typically, most forest operations, you'll see two, maybe three applications of chemicals in the first couple years after the trees, either right before or just after the trees are planted. And again, it's to knock back the brush and the grass to let the tree get established so it doesn't get overgrown, because they won't survive. Most of the dominant tree species in Oregon, the Oregon state tree, the Douglas fir, isn't a shade tolerant species. So if it gets outshaded by the faster growing maples and different brushes that are out there, they will end up dying. And so it's just a tool. Again, we don't encourage, we don't force anybody to use chemicals, but that's a tool that's in their chest. And just to talk a little bit more, if you look at the second bullet there, second and third bullet is really what I wanted to state here. You know, a lot of people tell us that the Forest Practices Act doesn't go far enough in its rules. Your rules aren't good enough. Well, we're only one part of the chemical rules in Oregon. We work with many different agencies, and I believe PARC has 10 other agencies. Is that right, Mike? I believe it's 10 other agencies that help regulate pesticide use in Oregon, and we're just one part of that. So you'll see and that's part of the reason I brought Mike Hodenthal along with Department of Ag. Anything that has to do with label restrictions or label violations, that's the Department of Ag. If it gets in the waters of the state, it could be Department of Environmental Quality. With us, you know, we have spray buffer distances. You'll see nothing in our rules about spraying around a home. That's not the charge that we have. We're charged with natural resources. There's other agencies that deal with that. So I know there's a lot of, again, consternation saying our act isn't as good as other states. I think overall, state-wise, we're better than other states simply because we specialize. We're more expertise agency by agency. We work collectively together. And like I said, I know Mike Odenthal's home phone number. I mean, that's how close we work together. If there's something that I see, I call Mike or I call David Waltz from DEQ, or you know, we work very collectively there. So that was really the reason I was trying to show that slide there. You'll see in our rules, we have special requirements about reporting and cleanup. You'll see, but they're very general rules, again, because we're not the only agency that's working there together. And here's a couple of our most specific rules here. You know, our big goal is to protect the resource, and that's to protect the waters. So no chemical application within specific distances. We have one of the rules is you have to protect all understory vegetation within 10 feet. So I don't care where you spray. If that vegetation ends up dying, you're in violation, and we write tickets for that. So that's kind of how our rules would work. When you talk about labels, we require that people follow the label. But if we think that they sprayed more than they were supposed to on the ground, the agency that would deal with that would be Department of Agriculture. They're more specific to the labels. If we go out there, though, and we see a buffer that's been sprayed, then we write that ticket. Another example of that is we don't allow helicopter spraying within 60 feet of a fish stream. So if we go out there, though, and we see that they've sprayed closer to that, that would be our citation to write. So there's several different agencies that get involved in regulating and enforcing the rules on these chemicals. One of the things that's in our rules is that they must take daily application records. And so when they're out there, they have to, in fact, I have a form. Yeah, I don't know how well you can see that. But there's a lot of different elements there that they have to record the weather, the wind, the temperature, the humidity, what they applied, the date they applied at the time. They have to keep those records for 3 years. If we believe that they've had reason to have an issue, we can request those records, but they don't have to turn them into us automatically. That is something that we can request from them, and if we do request it, they have to turn those in. So you'll see that in our rules as well. And this was a unit that was helicopter sprayed 2 years ago, in Western Lane District. And just to give an example of why landowners are using herbicides as a tool, if you see where that arrow is, there's a little fir tree right there at the tip of that arrow. The leader is right there on the top arrow, and you can see one of the limbs there off to the right. And a whole variety of other vegetation. That fir tree right there is what we call overtopped and would not survive. And so if you're looking at this, if you only own a half an acre, this is something that you could probably go treat manually by yourself. But when you're looking at a 100 acre or a 40 acre or whatever it may be, a clear cut, that's not a manageable means. And so, again, they chose herbicide in this sense to use that as a tool. What was? Then they would not be able to do that. They cannot directly apply to waters of the state. Yeah, I apologize if the photo appears. I was just simply trying to show the competing vegetation that they're dealing with here. And when I say that they grow brush as good or better than it grows trees, that's a pretty prime example there. And then just to finish, just to prove that Mike and I, for instance, work together, that's actually Mike right there in that one photo. And then you can see the helicopter applying. You can see the big clumps there are maple clumps. The Forest Practices Act is much more than just chemical oversight. And I'm kind of proud of being part of an agency that has a Forest Practices Act like the one that we do. We also, if you have registered water rights, they do have specific protection for registered water rights. What I will tell you there, out of personal experience, is that there's a lot of people that have domestic water systems in the Coast Range, and it's surprising few of those are actually registered. But what I'll also tell you is, in every instance that I can think of in working with neighboring landowners or the landowner that has that water source located on them, they will work with you and protect those as well. You know, they try to be good neighbors as much as they can. We, you know, it's like every other operation, just to give you numbers wise, we've got 4 stewardship foresters in Western Lane, and last year we had around 1,200 notifications of operations. And so some of those, one of the first things we do is we rate them for high, medium, and low priority as to what the need is and what the protected resources are. And to be honest with you, we've had very little problem with aerial application of chemicals as far as violations there. So we do randomly go out. We can't go out on every one of them, but we randomly go out and inspect these several a year. And we also get requests sometimes from the landowners or the operators who are actually applying the chemical for us to come out and just keep an eye on it as well. I would say in our district, we probably about a 10 to 12 a year on average as we go to actually watch the application. And what I will tell you, the interest, you know, what you know about chemicals, if you spray Roundup on your lawn, it dies. If we're out there and looking at subsequent inspections or in the area, one thing about herbicides, you can't miss where you've applied. And it makes it very easy, even if you're not there that day, if you're there 2 weeks later, the dead vegetation is very apparent. And so that's a pretty easy one to keep an eye on, actually. Whether it be memorandums of understanding or memorandums of agreement, but they're memorandums. But the agencies get together. You know, the Park Board is really the collection of all the agencies together, where they get together monthly and visit about the chemical rules and chemical issues. But depending on and I can tell you firsthand that I've called Mike Odenthal when I've seen things or heard of things in our office that weren't right. We've had spills where there happened to be an accident where a vehicle turned over, and there's a system where you call ORS. You can make one phone call, and they, much like Park, if you make that one phone call, they then will find the responsible agency to help out. But I have also, you know, just through our own partnerships, and you get to know somebody in a comfort level to where I've got an awful lot of cell phone numbers on my phone. And, you know, most definitely we work very closely with those other agencies.
Okay, for our next speaker, comparison of Forest Practices Act with other states, Lori Bernstein.
As Lisa showed you, this was a report that I helped co-author for Beyond Toxics. We analyzed herbicide spray records and released this report last December. I encourage you all to look at it online if you don't pick up a copy from Lisa. We analyzed 3 years of industrial forest herbicide spray records in the Triangle Lake area. Triangle Lake in the study area is located 12 to 14 miles west of Eugene. For years, rural communities in the vicinity of Triangle Lake complained from forestry herbicide sprays. In the spring of 2011, 43 of the residents there had their urine tested, and all 43 tested positive for 2,4-D and atrazine, two herbicides commonly used in forestry practices. After these findings of 100% of the urine were tested for found the samples found atrazine and 2,4-D, Oregon Health Authority took the lead on a public health exposure investigation. In October 2011, Oregon Health Authority requested all the herbicide application records for the area, and it took they requested them for the years 2009, 10, and 11. And it took 11 months. It wasn't until September of 2012 that they finally did receive all these application records. The spray records became part of the public record, and through a public records request, Beyond Toxics was able to access these spray records. To our knowledge, it was the first time spray records were available to the public and analyzed in Oregon. And these next slides are going to be some of our findings. This slide, I know it's pretty busy and hard to see, but the black outline is the study area that OHA identified. I need more hands. Right there is Triangle Lake, just to give you okay? Yeah, so Oregon Health Authority defined this study area, and what we see here is the clear-cut units that were sprayed in the study area for 2011. The dark red are the aerial spray units, and the orange are the ground spray units. Each unit is labeled with a code, which is probably pretty blurry at this projecting it at this level. Sorry about that. The codes are deciphered from the box in the top left corner. And what we see, you'll have to trust me if you don't see it, is right around here, there's a whole bunch of units that say 2AHFOGR. And what that means, using the box over here, is that, each of those units were sprayed with 2,4-D, atrazine, hexazinone, and two adjuvants were also used, foam buster and grounded. So adjuvants help herbicides be more effective, and so it might reduce foam or it might help the herbicide stick to the vegetation a little bit better. So what we see going on here is a mix of chemicals. It's basically a chemical soup. And when chemicals are mixed together, they can interact with each other, causing potentially more toxic effects. We call it synergistic effects. No research addresses how these specific mixes affect humans or the environment, and there is no EPA regulations that consider these synergistic effects. This is a study that found individually chemicals may not be too toxic, but when mixed together, they can have synergistic effects that could be lethal to fish. Now, it's hard to determine trends when only looking at 3 years of data. However, we did find a 99% increase in pounds of pesticide products sprayed, aerially sprayed, between 2009 and 2011. At the same time, aerial spray acres increased 56%. So an increase in acres was only part of the reason for an increase in pounds of pesticide sprayed. Perhaps more chemicals were being mixed together, or rates applied per acre may have increased. We haven't looked and teased up the data to figure that out yet. We also saw that over the 3 years, there was a total of 34,778 total pounds of pesticide products sprayed. That's more than 17 tons in this one study area. We did find units were sprayed multiple times. This slide shows a close-up of Fish Creek within the Triangle Lake study area. Fish Creek is a designated core cold water habitat stream for salmon and steelhead. The units in yellow were aerially sprayed one time. Units in orange were sprayed two times, and the red unit was sprayed three times. Keep in mind, this is only 3 years of data. So if we had previous and post-spray records, we may see no yellow and more red units. So another thing to point out here, to just explain this map a little further, is this highlighted stream in the middle here. Those are the salmon and steelhead habitat. The purple areas, like here and along there are areas where spray units were adjacent to salmon and steelhead habitat. The written plans for those spray records did indicate a 60-foot no-cut buffer. The highlighted green streams that we see, those are headwater and tributary streams that often flow directly into the salmon and steelhead habitat. Depending on the time of the year and the size of those tributaries, some may have been flowing during the time of the spray. And since these are non-fish-bearing streams, no buffers were required nor indicated on the written plans. This slide separates out the aerial sprays from spring and fall seasons. We clearly see a difference in the type of chemicals being sprayed during each season. 2,4-D, atrazine, and hexazinone are the most common chemicals sprayed in the spring months, while glyphosate and imazapyr are more common in the fall months. There was a 226% increase in pounds of pesticide products sprayed from spring 2009 to spring 2011, and this is when 100% of the residents tested positive for atrazine and 2,4-D in their urine samples. We also use an environmental and human health toxicity rating system. This was developed by Cornell University. Ratings above 10 are considered a toxicity concern. So all of the ratings were above 10, some more than others. Each column is one spray, and each color within that column represents a different chemical. The height is the toxicity rating for that chemical based on the rate per acre sprayed. We can see the chemicals, some chemicals in tank mixes have a higher toxicity rating than others. This rating does not address the possible synergistic effects. We do see that spring sprays for this data set are more toxic than the fall sprays. Spring is when streams are flowing higher and surface water is running off hillsides. Another thing to note here is that herbicides tend to bind with soil and can move downslope and into fish-bearing streams during this time. So now I'm going to talk more specifically about switching now to starting to compare to other neighboring states' regulations. Spray restrictions are not protecting Oregon water resources. Oregon allows all non-fish-bearing fish-bearing streams to be sprayed, including ones that flow directly into threatened and endangered listed salmon streams. Washington and Idaho, on the other hand, have no spray buffers that protect all surface waters for aerial and ground sprays. This table compares buffer widths for our neighboring states. We feel Washington is particularly comparable to Oregon with similar habitats and growing conditions. In the 1990s, Washington looked extensively into the research and developed new chemical rules and regulations. As this chart indicates, a typical width of a no-spray buffer for fish-bearing streams in forests similar to Oregon coast would be between 100 and 150 degrees. Feet. In Washington, it's not cookie cutter. It's not just because it's a fish-bearing stream, it gets a certain width. It depends on the location of where those trees are, in like how fast they might grow or how slow they might grow. And it also depends on the weather conditions and how the height of the helicopter and the type of nozzle that they're spraying with. So what we see here for fish-bearing streams, in Oregon we have a 60-foot no-cut. In Washington, there's ranges for typical streams similar to the Oregon coast is 100 to 150 feet, and in Idaho it's 100 feet. For perennial non-fish-bearing streams, in Oregon it's 0 feet no-spray buffer. In Washington it's a 50 to 100-foot no-spray, and in Idaho it's 100 feet no-spray. For intermittent streams, when surface water is flowing at the time of application, they get treated exactly as perennial streams in Washington and Idaho with the same buffers. So what's really the big take-home message here is that all surface waters are protected in our neighboring states, but not we don't feel like they are being protected here. Okay, buffers next to residential and agricultural lands. Oregon has a 0-foot has no buffer for either. In Washington, there's a 200-foot buffer for residences, and in Idaho, it's a half a mile, and it's expanded buffers for certain types of formulations of 2,4-D. For agricultural lands, again, Oregon has no buffer. In Washington, it's 100 feet. And in Idaho, again, it's a half a mile. And up to 5 miles away for a high volatile ester formulation of 2,4-D, which, by the way, was also, that form of ester was recently reported as being sprayed in the Cedar Valley sprays area. Aerial spray restrictions are not protecting groundwaters. Oregon has no provision to protect groundwaters. Washington requires environmental analysis and bans certain restricted chemicals, including atrazine and hexazinone. Washington has mapped out all vulnerable groundwater areas throughout the whole state, so they are jump right on it if there's anything proposed. If they do, if a spray is proposed in the area, a SEPA analysis must be done. What that stands for is, if you're familiar with NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, it's an environmental analysis. And in Washington, it's SEPA, State Environmental Policy Act, where they have their own environmental analysis that they do for certain impacts, potential impacts. Or aerial spray restrictions are not protecting Oregon's domestic water resources. Oregon requires only a 60-foot no-spray buffer for domestic water sources. Washington requires an environmental analysis and a 200-foot no-spray buffer. This is a photo of a sprayed clearcut in Oregon. This man is standing at his drinking water source at the base of the clearcut. It's hard to imagine runoff from this unit does not impact his drinking water. Washington, so these are additional regulations and agency responsibilities. The first one here, SEPA review for chemicals with high toxicity. Washington uses an online database to determine if the proposed pesticide has a high toxicity rating, and if it does, it triggers a SEPA review. The slide after this will go into that in a little bit more detail. Agency review period. Oregon Department of Forestry receives the spray notifications, but it's to our understanding that they cannot comment or review them. Washington has a 3-week comment period. Since the agencies in Oregon cannot make public comments, as far as neither can the Oregon public. And if the public, as Link mentioned, as the public wants access to spray notification, they must pay for them. Washington has an online database that allows the public to review all spray notifications without any fee. Their process also allows for public comments. Posting of the site. Residents in Oregon do not have to be told when the sprays are occurring. Even if the spray is adjacent to their property. In many cases, they are told, but they don't have to be told. In Washington, spray units must be posted 5 days in advance and remain posted 15 days after spraying. The reason why our analysis only covers 3 years of data is because Oregon only requires landowners to keep spray records for 3 years. Washington requires records to be kept for 7 years. Keeping records longer than 3 years may be helpful for future research. So this is that online database that I mentioned. These are some of the forestry chemicals Washington has identified as having a toxicity rating of danger, and this is what triggers a SEPA analysis. From this list, there's three chemicals that we observed in the Triangle Lake data. Hardball, Velpar DF, and Westar were all sprayed in the Triangle Lake study area. The federal agencies that manage timberlands in western Oregon banned aerial spraying of pesticides in the 1980s. They concluded that spraying herbicide is not an environmentally sound practice and is not necessary for industrial harvesting of timber. Last December, two federal agencies, NOAA and EPA, requested public comments on their findings that Oregon Forest Practices Act falls short of protecting coastal streams. Following that announcement, the Columbia Basin Fish and Wildlife News Bulletin reported that EPA and NOAA had determined Oregon's logging practices for private lands were inadequate to protect small and medium-sized streams, and that there was a need to limit pesticide contamination. They went on to report that federal agencies repeatedly pointed to far more protective logging practices in Washington and California. In January, the Register Guard, Eugene's newspaper, wrote a staff editorial that pointed out the inability for the Oregon public to access spray records. They also suggested that Oregon legislatures need to look towards Washington laws, state laws, as a minimum standard. So, in conclusion, it's our current Oregon regulations protecting natural resources and human health in rural communities. And has Oregon Forest Practices Act fallen behind current science, and does it use best management practices to date?
My name is Frances Etherington, and I live in Douglas County. And I'm going to start off this panel by sharing with you some personal experiences of what it's like to live amongst industrial timber forest land. This here is a picture of my home west of Roseburg, and it's surrounded by industrial forest land. And Oregon has a unique history that mixes up rural families and industrial landowners, and I want to briefly go over this history with you so you understand why we live right next to this industrial forest land. When Oregon became a state in 1859, the federal government tried to encourage white settlement through various land grant schemes like the Homestead Act and the railroad land grants. However, much of that land did not get into the hands of settlers because of these massive land fraud deals that happened at the turn of the century. So instead, much of this land that was slated to go to settlers was instead homesteaded by the timber industry, which is why we have a huge amount of every other section in Oregon owned by the timber industry. And this has proven a problem, especially in Douglas County where I live, because of course now timber industry owns most of their private land, and nestled in between the huge tracts of industrial land are little rural resident families like mine. And this is the reason why the counties are so strapped for money. Douglas County is broke in part because the large timber companies pay far less property taxes and harvest taxes than smaller private landowners. So there is virtually very little property tax money going into the counties, which is one of the reasons why in Douglas County all our libraries are now closed. We have no public libraries anymore. So this is my home in Western Oregon. When I first drove up the driveway and saw it in 1975, I looked at this and I said, wow, look at those cliffs. They're never going to get us from behind. little did I know that that's exactly where they will get us. These are the Callahan Cliffs. It's a sandstone formation that rises 800 feet above us. And most of the trees you see there are owned by Roseburg Forest Products, to within just feet of the house up there. And on the right side is Seneca land, and on the left and up at the ridgetop is Weyerhaeuser. So this is a picture of Roseburg Forest Products spraying fertilizer to within a few feet of our house in 2005. They didn't give us notice that they were going to do this, so you can imagine my surprise one morning when I was walking to the chicken coop in my bathrobe, and this helicopter comes zooming on down virtually right in front of me and hovers right there. So close, I could see the people inside talking to each other. And I'm just standing there appalled in my bathrobe. They later explained that they were pinpointing our property boundary. But at the time, of course, I didn't know what they were doing there. And I just stared at this invader, and then I kind of came to my senses, and I raised my hand and gave them my finger. And they immediately flew away after I did that. I said, that's the answer, right? But then they started spraying unknown substance all around our house. They used our house, right above our house, they would turn around and go back. So that was one of our first experiences with this aerial spray. So then in 2010, Seneca, who is more on our right side of that cliffs you saw, they clear cut their property, and it catechordes our property. And so we could see them logging this part of it that was so steep that the loggers had to use ropes here in order, coming down ropes with chainsaws to cut the trees down right there. This is the full extent of that clear cut there. Now, five months after they clear cut this,
we received a letter from Seneca about their upcoming herbicide spraying. And the letter said, I'm just going to quote, "Greetings from your neighbor, Seneca Jones Timber Company. We are a locally owned, managed timber company, and as such, we earnestly desire to maintain good communications and rapport with our neighbors. The purpose of this letter is to notify you that Seneca plans to aerial apply herbicides to our tree farm, which is near your property. All pesticide application work is performed by licensed applicators and under the close supervision of professional foresters who have many years of training and experience in herbicide application. The United States Environmental Protection Agency has registered and approved each chemical we use to assure the safety of our workers and our neighbors, as well as the forest environment." Unquote. So this is a letter they sent out to adjoining landowners who are about ready to get doused. But so we called them up and we said that we wanted to be notified of the exact date they were going to apply the herbicides, and they don't have to tell us. But in Seneca's case, they usually do. If you ask them, they will tell you. And one morning at 5 a.m., we got the phone call that they were going to spray, and so we jumped in our car and drove up to where there was a good viewpoint that where we could film it in a safe distance away. So this is some of what we saw right here. You know, people often ask, and it addressed this in the movie a bit, why are they spraying? I mean, do you see anything there? What are they spraying for? Well, the reason they are spraying is so they can kill every living thing in their clear cut except for what is going to make them money. And it is all about money.
Wouldn't it be great to see the African plains before they lay it to waste and only the bones remain? Wouldn't it be poetry to shoot holes in the punches we see with an elephant gun and an helicopter's fly shooting rhinos from out of the sky?
brought to you by Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Built on the site where an actual ancient rainforest once stood, see a full-scale replica of a Douglas fir tree. See pictures of trees larger in diameter than a man is tall. Trout and salmon that once choked the rivers of the Northwest will sing to you in our chamber of taxidermy. Hear the disaffected sounds of Feller Buncher and his bunch of fellers, an all-ex-logger band, in our simulated wood amphitheater. Take the Oregon Desert Highway to the clear-cut road exit, turn right at the stump in the road, and you're at Silt River Tree Museum and Casino. Free parking, kids a buck and a half, closed during summer months due to melting asphalt, giant locusts, and methyl ethyl hydroxy colchicine slag emissions.